You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire. Last week, survivors of institutionalised abuse spoke at the first religion-based redress hearings of the Royal Commission. The New Zealand Catholic Church announced that they will learn from their past mistakes and do their part to stop abuse in care. I talked to Dr. Stephen Winter about the outcomes he hopes to see from the Royal Commission and his research into monetary redress programs.
Also, just a content warning for this piece as well.
Probably the most important thing that, well, let's start with, is the fact that there isn't, that's really hard to say, right? Because there are a range of institutions that have more or less formal processes by which people can obtain monetary redress. So, this, you know, we have at least three different programs operating within the state, each run by different ministries, you know, MSD and education and health, and then Aranga Tamariki as well for more recent stuff. And then the faith-based institutions like the Catholic Church, the Anglican Church, will run theirs. And even inside those institutions, because they're disaggregated, you know, they, so like a single school might run its own program, as it were. And the numbers of people involved are so small at those levels, to even call them programs would be sort of, it's really more often the case that these are kind of one-off, sort of negotiated settlements. So there's a lot of variation. And then that means it's kind of hard to know what's going on because, like, say, for a case, like, if you want to go and get compensation from a Catholic diocese, you know, that process is going to be private, potentially subject to confidentiality restrictions.
How difficult is it to make a claim of institutionalized abuse, particularly if it occurred during childhood?
It can be incredibly difficult. And the difficulties don't just stop with the, you know, the challenges around evidence, right? Because you know, what kind of records are available with respect to abuse are often really poor. Indeed, even, you know, sort of basic records about, you know, where people were at what time. Those kind of records can be very challenging to get. I'll give you an example. Aaron Smell, who published a series of articles, he's done some research into this, and he notes that in the there was a white trial, as it were, in 2006, 2007, and I think I'm right about that one. But anyways, whatever the they had 28 named offenders, and they can only get personnel files for less than 10 of those named offenders. You know, when the Department of Welfare became MSD, they got rid of, you know, they trashed the personnel files, destruction. So those kind of background institutional records are missing. But when people come and talk about, say, things like sexual abuse, well, nobody ever wrote those things down, right? You know, that wasn't part of the regular, sort of keeping track of people kind of thing. Indeed, quite the opposite. There's, you know, sort of knowledge of this stuff might be actively repressed. And so there isn't that kind of documentary evidence lying around. And then obviously there's the problem with historical testimony. All different kinds of sort of evidentiary problems emerge in that space. Adding to that is the psychological difficulties that people go through in attempting to provide testimony can be incredibly difficult for people involving a process of re-traumatization as they sort of go back and have to remember such experiences. And the processes can be really protracted, take place over a long period of time. They can be financially costly, involving lawyers. And Sonia Cooper, who has done incredible work for survivors here in New Zealand, has talk about how she struggles to sort of keep going with cases with an absence of funding, you know, in terms of getting legal aid and so on.
What monetary compensation has actually been given to survivors in New Zealand, and has New Zealand identified what the adequate level of compensation is?
Many people have obtained settlements. Now, I don't know the numbers out of the religious institutions. In terms of the state, we're talking in the low thousands. So the process has sort of emerged organically through, you know, sort of settlements, as it were. And the actual numbers themselves, like what the sort of who obtained how much for what kinds of injuries, has been sort of kept secret, kept private. Only recently has it been announced and made public. And, you know, is it adequate? I think that's a hard question to answer. It certainly is a great deal less than comparative types of programs overseas. Though, to be fair, some of those comparisons, you know, compare apples and oranges, because in overseas jurisdictions they take account of consequential damage, for example, whereas here in New Zealand, long-term consequential damage is seen as something that, you know, say, could be the responsibility of ACC, and which is actually another place where people can get compensation. I neglected to mention that in the original sort of description.
And has partnership with Māori communities in New Zealand been a factor in redressing historical abuse?
In my impression has been that the engagement with Māori people through the redress process has been suboptimal. You know, there was a report, you can go online on the MSDU website, sort of looking into the Māori experiences in MSDU's redress processes, and it is strongly critical of that particular program in terms of its failure to sort of reflect Te No Rangatira Tanga to operate in a culturally appropriate fashion. Specifically, as far as I know, there weren't any Māori individuals involved in the provision of redress in, say, MSD at the time for many years. And so you have probably a very large disproportionate number of Maori survivors engaging with what they saw, what has been said, at least by that report, as a culturally inappropriate process.
Now we'll just move on to what's happening with the Royal Commission's faith-based redress hearings. Sure. The Catholic bishops and congregational bishops have said that they want to learn from past mistakes and uphold their commitment to stopping abuse within the church. What are your thoughts on this?
I think that it's great to see the churches supporting the process. That hasn't always been the case. Certainly here in New Zealand and certainly elsewhere. It's something I think that people will be watching sort of going forward to see how full-throated that support is.
New Zealand's monetary redress programs, how do they compare to overseas?
Well, they're really informal. Many overseas programs repose upon legislation or ministerial sort of regulatory documents, you know, that set out what the program will do, how it'll operate, right? New Zealand's had nothing like that. It's been very sort of informal, right? Developing in response to, basically as a negotiated settlement for some court cases, you know, in the mid-2000s, you know, the last decade. So that's a real big difference, the sort of informality here in New Zealand versus the more formal structures that we see overseas in places like Canada and Ireland and so on. But that's not to say those other programs are themselves identical. You know, the Irish process was one of, you know, sort of legislations passed for the industrial schools program, for example, whereas in Canada, you know, the Indian Residential School Settlement Agreement emerged out of a class action lawsuit. It was a settlement. So there's lots of variations. So, but that's one sort of real difference here in New Zealand is the informal sort of developmental, organic process that's happened here in New Zealand versus a more formal, structured and regulated process.
Is there just anything else that you wanted to add on this topic?
How many days do you have?
Yeah, 15 minutes. I know it's a short time to get a lot of information across.
Yeah, that's fair. That's fair. The other main thing that I, you know, comes, you know, pops to my head is, as part of that informality of that process has been a lack of transparency and independence, right? So those are some, you know, sort of big ticket items that I think anybody talking to you about the New Zealand case would pick out. So in terms of transparency, it's been hard to know how the process operates because it's, you know, there aren't any rules written down, as it were. So it's very much up to potentially individual people working within the ministry as to how particular claims are going to be processed, which means it's hard for those people who are putting the claims forward to know what it is that they ought to do, what kind of standards they're going to be judged against, and so on. So a real lack of transparency as to how the process operates has been a real problem here in New Zealand. And related to that point is a question of independence. So whereas in places like Canada and Ireland and Scotland, Northern Ireland, and so on, these kinds of programs have been operated by independent boards, tribunals, often staffed by judges, not always, but often staffed by judges, you know, or other people with sort of professional habits of independence, the New Zealand processes have been run by those organizations that are responsible for the original offending, the original injuries. And so for many people would see this as sort of, you know, putting the offender in charge of their own punishment, as it were, right? And also in charge of their own investigating the cases and all that. So, and that was a point that Sonia Cooper, I believe, made in a complaint or a submission to the UN Committee on Torture, I'm thinking, several years ago now. And so one thing I would certainly hope to see come out of this Royal Commission would be a process that was established on an independent footing so that the MSD and or the Catholic Church and so on weren't in charge of how cases are investigated and their outcomes.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.